Hey, everybody. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman here at the Green Power Wellness Show on TRN. We got a full agenda today. Like everybody else in the country, of course, we're talking about a bit about this these hearings on the Supreme Court. But then we're going to get to some real stuff about energy, the hurricanes, global warming, and also a major story in the New York Times today about new developments with the zinc air batteries. Which I think are going to make a big difference. We missed our opening music this morning, so if you're this afternoon, so if you're a little disoriented, we're just starting the show right off. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show on PRN. I've got Joel Siegel. Joel, are you with us?
What's up, my brother? Sluggo, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? Do I have Nancy LaPaca with us?
Yeah, hi, Harvey.
How are you, Nancy? Good to have you with us. Mustafa Ali? Okay.
He'll be joining us shortly.
Okay, and we have one other person. Do we have another woman with us?
Kim Porter.
Kim, are you with us, Kim? Okay, so Kim may join us as well. We got plenty to go, plenty to talk about. Joel Siegel, I wanted to start with you and talking about these Kavanaugh hearings, which I have avoided, by the way. I will read the reviews, and then I'll watch what I want to watch on YouTube later on. I did catch a glimpse of the woman who accused him, and she looked quite solid to me. But I want to talk to you, Joel, about your history in the South. You were a Southerner. And you went to law school in the South, and you are familiar with the culture that this scumbag comes from. I, of course, haven't made up my mind yet about whether – I guess I haven't. So I watched the Clarence Thomas hearings. That's how old I am. And I am not going to watch this another time. But in that day, you couldn't control your viewing schedule as we can today. So I'm going to opt in and watch her on YouTube tonight, and then I'll see if I want to watch what this perp rapist scumbag frat boy drunken molester and completely unfit to be in the judiciary at all had to say. But Joel, since we haven't formed our opinion yet, tell us what you think about the culture this guy came from, and is it credible that he did what he did?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in the South, I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and I graduated in 81 from college, and I went to law school there 85 to 89, and I heard a plethora of stories about how the fraternities would spike the punch bowl with drugs and alcohol, and the purpose of it was to get the women drunk so, you know, they could take advantage of them. That's called rape, by the way. And the Guardian...
Well, it wasn't then. It wasn't called rape then. It was called, you know, good old boys having fun, right?
Good old boys
having fun. It wasn't called rape back then.
The only problem with the having fun is the Guardian reported that frat brothers raped 300% more, and 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted on campus. And I think the real issue is, you know, I talked to my sister. She went to the University of Florida, Gainesville, and she heard about it all the time as well. One of her, there was a fraternity at the University of Florida where they were accused of, you know, the same, you know, allegation against Kavanaugh. So this is, I mean, you can go just Google, you know, fraternities and rape, and it's school after school after school, especially in the South. And the statistics show that it's basically white privileged males fraternities where you do see the higher incidence of sexual assault and rape. And, you know, and then the real question is, you know, what are we going to do about it? And you're going to get a slap on the wrist, or there's those who are saying ban fraternities altogether. Some experts are saying give them a year, you know, ban them for a year. And then others, you know, I think are saying we got to start education, starting, you know, elementary school, junior high, high school, college. I was just talking to Kim Porter about this. I hope she is on the call now. But, you know, and that's got to start in the home. It's got to start early.
Kim Porter, you've joined us?
Yes, I've been on here. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Go ahead, Joel.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, the objectification of women, right, as sex objects, that's one thing. But, you know, rape is a very, very, that's a violent act. But one of the things that the experts have agreed upon is that the sexual assaults are, you know, linked to excessive, you know, drinking, but also showing power over women and control. So it's more than just sex. It's another, you know, mentality that you've talked about in your soon-to-be-released book, People's History of America, you know, that stems all the way to the Puritan culture. And I think it's just cruelty. And no one's talking about just male cruelty towards women. These men know what they're doing are cruel, but they do it anyway. So why are they so cruel? Are these the same men that keep people homeless and without jobs and without food and leaving Puerto Rico without food and housing? I think they are.
Unbelievable. It's well, Christina, you have to remember we have a rapist in the White House. So, you know, it's quite a role model here for our children and for the rest of the world. And Nancy McClaka, do you want to jump in on this?
You know, not really. There's been a lot said.
Okay.
Honestly, I think I'm going to say anything that other people haven't said 10 times. So thank you, though.
All right, Kim.
Yes, I'm having trouble hearing. Well, I'll just say, you know, we live in a very sexist society, a very patriarchal society, and you look at how far we've come in the history where, you know, women were considered property, didn't have the right to vote, didn't have civil rights, any kind of rights at all in the history of our country. And so, you know, we've come a long way, but we have a long way to go. And, you know, I was a social worker. I worked with sexual abuse victims. I've seen a lot of harm that's done for males and females. But the fact of the matter is that men have a lot more power in our society, and our society has generally overlooked issues of sexual harassment and rape for a long time. And we really need to educate our children from a very young age, not only at home, but in the school system, in faith institutions, in every aspect of life, so that people don't use their power to abuse and take advantage of other people. And, you know, until that happens on a large scale, we're going to continue to have problems. So it's really important for the education, and also that the legal system catch up and do what it needs to be doing. Because we know that less than 1% of women who allege rape, with less than 1% of the perpetrators are actually incarcerated. So, you know, the statistics are not looking good, and we need to do something about it now. We can't wait.
Mustafa Ali, have you joined us? Mustafa Ali? No, okay. So, I just got to say, Joel Siegel is reading my history book. I think that what this is really happening here in the bigger picture is that we are transitioning away from a male-dominated society. This kind of horrifying attack on women, and that's what this is. It's an attack on women. Is really a rear guard holding action by men who are resisting where we're going, which is towards a matriarchy. I mean, the United States of America was founded as a democracy, more or less, based on what happened with the Iroquois Confederacy and the other indigenous tribes in this country, and they were all matriarchies. And they ran perfectly well. They ran well, let's put it that way. The Iroquois Confederacy, also known as the Haudenosaunee, came together. They were the five tribes in northern New York, in New York State, were at war, and they joined into a confederacy, and the men, the chiefs were all men, but they were all chosen by the women, and the women ran the society. And that's where we're headed now. I think basically men have failed in running this country and in running the world. And women are a majority. They're a majority of the voting population in this country, and a majority of the college students, a majority of the law students now. And what this is scumbag Kavanaugh is just, and the bigger scumbag in the White House, these are just remnants of a dying patriarchy, as far as I'm concerned, and this kind of ugliness where you've got, you know, not one but two rapists on the Supreme Court, if this guy is approved, a rapist in the White House. This basically has to end. And God forbid they confirm this guy. Not only is he unfit in terms of male-female relationships, but even more important to a certain extent, he's unfit as a jurist to have anything to do with the highest court in this land, which some people, I have friends who are really adamant that the Supreme Court shouldn't exist anyway. And that's a whole other discussion. And I think there's a strong case to be made. If you go back to John Marshall and the beginnings of the court, it has its problems, let's put it that way. Did anyone want to jump in on that before we move on to the environmental purpose of the show?
Yeah, Harvey, I'd like to jump in. I mean, this is the most dangerous Supreme Court nominee that we've ever had, and we've had a lot of them, right? But he wants to overturn Roe versus Wade. And the Supreme, I remember before I left Congressman Conyers' office, he called me into his office and he just said, the Supreme Court is the most right-wing, dangerous Supreme Court we've ever had in the 48 years I've been in Congress. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, because they're now legislating, they're not judging. Conyers was a former judge. But here's a man being accused of rape, which is, you know, power over women. And then you can draw a straight line to his ideology, which once again, he wants to have the power over women's right to choose. And that's pretty, it's pretty frightening that in 2018, the law of the land, Roe versus Wade, right, which is the majority support of women and the American people, he is a dangerous, far right-wing, anti-government radical. And that is something that, for some reason, it's being left out of the press narrative. Is he, the Supreme Court could overturn Roe versus Wade, and they're crazy enough to do it because this court is no longer, you know, objective. Not that they were always objective, but this court is, you know, they're changing what was once left to the Congress, whether it's, you know, Medicaid expansion or, you know, gutting the 1965 Civil Rights Act with the Shelby case. They're very, very dangerous. And people are talking about 18-year term limits is what people are talking about.
Well, I mean, we could abolish the court altogether. And yes, as far as I'm concerned, and of course, he's not, you say he's anti-government, in some cases he is, but, you know, he's more than happy to have the government intrude itself into the bodies of women and intrude itself in a thousand different ways in terms of basically fascist anti-civil liberties legislation, crushing the free press and all that stuff. And this guy, you know, Clarence Thomas has not surprised anybody. He has, his record on the court is horrendous. He has voted against every, well, with one exception, every civil liberties law or civil rights law. The one exception was he voted for free speech when it came to the Playboy Channel. That was his one foray into libertarianism when it comes to civil liberties. But these guys are completely anti-union. They're completely anti-environment. You watch, this guy gets on the court, this piece of garbage that they want to put up there. They will vote, for example, to overturn California's more stringent air quality laws. And California has now voted to require new homes to be solarized. I will bet you that will go to the Supreme Court. There's already a pro-nuclear group that has challenged it legally, even though the homeowners have tremendous financial benefits. And so this guy gets on there. He will join with Clarence Thomas and the other right wingers, and they will overturn every piece of environmental legislation that they can get their hands on. I mean, that's a guarantee. So does anybody else want to chime in on this before we move on? As I say, I have made a point of not watching these hearings. I'll watch tonight the same way I watch Colbert on YouTube, and I'll see how much of it I can stand. What are your predictions? Let's take a quick poll. Joel, do you think this guy's going to be approved?
Yes.
Nancy?
I'm ready to talk about solar if you are.
All right. Mustafa, you haven't joined us? No.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, Mustafa, yes. We've been talking. Have you heard us? We've been talking about the Supreme Court hearings, and we're about to jump away. Is there anything you want to add in?
Yeah, no, I think that the deck was already stacked for him. You know, they've done everything in their power to try and clear his name, to make him, as he defined himself, as a choir boy. So I think it's very difficult to see a situation where he doesn't get confirmed.
All right, Kim Porter?
I have no comment about this right now, about that specific case. Thanks.
All right, let's head in. We'll head into solar and to the hurricanes and to global warming. We've got a full 43 minutes left to do that. We're going to start with you, Nancy Laplaca. I will say that before we lose track of it, there's a major story on the front page of the New York Times today, very timely for our radio show. I'm sure they knew we were going to be on the air and they wanted to run it so we'd be able to discuss it. The guy who owns the Los Angeles Times, the new purchaser of the Los Angeles Times, has now come out and said that he has a zinc air battery that, if you read between the lines, he's saying that basically it's at least as good, if not better, as the lithium ion batteries that are out there. If that's true, that's a huge deal. And it really makes the solarization of our country and our world a much more reachable goal. Let's put it that way. Nancy, do you want to introduce yourself and jump in into the world of solar energy here?
Yeah, my name is Nancy Laplaca, and I'm an energy policy consultant. I served as policy advisor to a commissioner for 4 years in Arizona. The years I was there, which were 2009 to 2013, Arizona moved forward on solar, and now they're going backwards. The utilities there are fighting very hard against it. And that is a very exciting article that you bring up, Harvey, but where the rubber hits the road is where I work. It is the regulatory proceedings and the permits that actually put generation batteries and power permits online. And so it's one thing to have a technology that's new and great and wow, bang, biz, you know, but it's another thing to have it come online. And I think it's really exciting, and I don't doubt that there are many utilities taking a look at it right now. I mean, just at the same time that we have utilities like Duke Energy, the third largest utility in the country, Southern Company, AEP, Arizona Public Service, Tucson Electric Power, all these utilities pushing against batteries, the list of utilities and applications where batteries are being used just gets longer and longer. And the power purchase agreements that utilities are signing are as low as 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour just for solar, 2.4 cents a kilowatt hour in Nevada, 2.5 in Arizona. And then when you add in battery storage, you're getting to 4 and 5 cents a kilowatt hour for solar plus batteries. And these are astounding numbers. And the numbers are getting so low that utilities are pushing back in multiple ways. They're pushing back in deregulated states,
by trying to get rid of PURPA and trying to change the rules of the game to shut out solar and batteries, and they're operating in regulated states like North Carolina, where we don't even have evidentiary hearings on these, you know, where we should be having discussions about the cost of solar plus batteries. We don't even have an evidentiary hearing. So I would say, Harvey, I know you know a lot about the process and that the process is broken. And the process in many states, particularly in the Southeast, is non-existent. And so we don't even have a discussion about what are the costs and benefits of clean energy.
Unbelievable. And where are you now, Nancy? Where do you work now?
I'm in North Carolina, and it's interesting because I've worked the most in Colorado, Arizona, North Carolina, and done a lot of research on Florida. And the interesting thing to me is that if you look at Xcel Energy, they are considered the most forward-thinking utility in America right now, and the reason is very simple. They're in eight states, and the states that they're in are very heavy on solar and wind, and they are calling their policy steel for fuel. That's what David Eve, who's the chair of Xcel, calls it, and that's a very simple reason. In other words, steel, which is mostly wind, because wind is 1.8 cents a kilowatt hour on average in the country right now, for fuel, because basically wind and solar displace fuel. And as the cost of these technologies comes down, 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 it's getting to the point now where solar and wind, especially wind, is directly competitive for the cost of fuel alone. Now, the reason why Xcel Energy in Colorado is willing to embrace, and the PUC's already passed it, 55% clean energy by 2025, think about it, 50% by 2025, is because it pencils out. Because if they don't have to spend $2, $3 billion a year buying coal and natural gas, to say nothing of the waste, the coal ash, the cleanup, the mercury, the pollution, the health disaster, then they're actually going to be saving money. So we are at a point now, finally, where clean energy is cheaper. And so the only way the utilities are controlling dirty energy, like Arizona, which is 6% solar and 40% coal, is because they manipulate the processes and the types of information that comes in so that they continue making bad decisions. It's a tragedy.
Amazing. Whatever happened to the free market, right? So you threw some numbers around, and I'll go to you, Kim, in a second. But, Nancy, you said under 2 cents a kilowatt hour for wind, but under 3 for solar with storage. Compare that, please, to coal, oil, nukes, and gas, what I call King Kong. What are the how do the numbers stack up against fossil and nuclear fuels?
Yeah, the numbers right now, the best numbers that we're getting in the country for solar in the sunniest places are like 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour or less. Nevada was 2.4. When you put storage, it changes the equation because storage is a more complex investment because you've got ramp up time and you've got also how much electricity are you going to get? In other words, how many hours are you going to get that electricity? And so storage is more complex. It adds a level of complexity to the regulatory proceedings that hasn't existed before. So it takes more brain power to deal with it. But the bottom line is that on average, it costs about 3 cents a kilowatt hour to generate coal. That doesn't count the coal ash, the cleanup, the mercury, the health damages. To give you some big numbers that are pretty astounding, the United States utilities spend about $400 billion a year from selling electricity, $400 billion. They purchase about $40 billion in coal and about $40 billion in gas. That $40 billion in raw coal that utilities purchase does $520 billion a year in damages. That's Dr. Paul Epstein from Harvard a decade ago. If you look at, so coal, 3 cents a kilowatt hour to generate. Gas, it depends on the cost of the gas. It depends on whether it's combined cycle or a peaker. But the raw, but bottom line is about, it's about 4 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour. Maybe if it's a peaker, it's about 7 or 8. Wind, is it now at 1.8 cents a kilowatt hour? If we did offshore wind, which has much higher capacity factors, in other words, it runs for many, many more hours of the year, it's much more dependable wind, the cost will go up. It will be maybe 4 cents a kilowatt hour to start, 5. But it's very dependable. It has a very high capacity factor. In other words, it runs many hours of the year. Nuclear is a wild card. If you look at Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station in Arizona, which I'm very familiar with, I've been working on that power plant since the 80s when it was built, the price is very cheap. It's about 4 cents a kilowatt hour on the open market out there. But if you look at a cost of a new nuclear kilowatt hour, like the Vogtle plant in Georgia, that's up to $25 billion. And they're not even sure that that's the end of it. So, Harvey, you can address that better than me, but I think they're up to 20 cents a kilowatt hour, maybe 25 cents a kilowatt hour. So there's no contest anymore between nuclear and clean energy. And as many people point out, no one is financing nuclear. Nuclear is dead. They can slap their gums all they want about it. It's dead. And the problem with gas is that if people like David Hughes and Art Berman and Richard Heinberg and all the other people who do research on shale are correct, the supplies are overestimated. So not only do we have staggering damages, staggering environmental justice issues, but we also have supplies that are overestimated by 50 to 100%, which means that $30 billion in pipelines and over $100 billion in new gas plants could become stranded assets, just like all those nuclear assets.
All right, Nancy LaPlaca, thank you for that rundown. It's fantastic. I'm here in California. They're talking now about offshore wind 30 or 40 miles into the ocean with 12 megawatt windmills. That will, I'm sure outstrip everybody, even solar at this point in time. You're not going to lose that much in transmission with underwater cables. What's Kim Porter? You're still with us, I hope?
Yes.
Okay. I want to thank Joel Siegel for bringing us all together today. Joel did his usual organizer's magic. And Kim, tell us where you are and what you're working on, and give us a little bit on energy, please.
Sure. I'm Kim Porter. I am a community organizer for North Carolina Warren in North Carolina, and I'm here today representing the Poor People's Campaign of North Carolina as the co-chair of the Ecological Devastation Committee. I co-chair that committee with William J. Barber III. And basically, you know, I can talk about North Carolina and what we're seeing. You know, just recently we had the Hurricane Florence. And basically, I mean, it's just unbelievable, the crises that our state has faced, with only a storm being not nearly as harsh as they thought it was going to be. And yet we had millions of chickens and turkeys that were drowned, you know, thousands of gallons of raw sewage spilled onto the streets in different communities. We have coal ash that has breached. We have the hog lagoons that have breached. And we know that, you know, this has been contributed, or can be accounted for because of climate change. Not that we didn't have storms before, we're going to continue to have them, but the intensity and the increase of superstorms, of flooding, of fires, of hurricanes and that kind of thing, is just, you know, at an all-time peak because of global warming due to, you know, the burning of fossil fuels, the drive of methane, fracking gas that we've seen in our country and all over the world. And the fact of the matter is that Duke Energy, which is the largest corporate utility in the United States, it's the second largest corporate utility in the world, their headquarters, their national, international headquarters is right here in North Carolina in Charlotte. So we really need to hold Duke Energy accountable in part for this storm, for Florence, because they're only utilizing, Duke Energy is only utilizing about 2% renewable energy right now. And in the next 15 years, they are calling for only up to 7% renewable energy, which just isn't nearly enough. So they're contributing to climate change because they're such a large corporate utility. And we know that we really need to, you know, increase the amount of solar and wind that we have. North Carolina has a wind moratorium through December of 2018, but it should be lifted after that. And, you know, part of the solution that I see in North Carolina, for example, is through our North Carolina Clean Path 2025, which is a proposal by NC Warren with Bill Powers, who's an engineer who came up with an over 100-page document on how North Carolina could become fossil-free by 2030, 100% reduction in utility fossil fuels. And so this would really help us to fight climate change, with Duke being an international corporate utility. And support of what I'm working on is to promote the North Carolina Clean Path 2025. And then also in looking at with the Poor People's Campaign in North Carolina, we recently had a press conference with Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II. And, you know, he was calling for our, and we were calling for our legislators and our governor to have access to health care in North Carolina, an extension of Medicaid. And in saying that, you know, we already had a storm before the Hurricane Florence hit North Carolina, with our legislators not expanding Medicaid, which affects over 500,000 people. We need to increase minimum wage. We need to establish regulation on corporate utility, Duke Energy, and on agribusinesses for hog farming and chicken and turkey farms. We need to assure access to affordable housing for people. And we need to spend less money on war, a war machine, and more money to help people and for human rights, basically. That's what we're talking about. We all have the right to live. Well, we all have the right to a good life. And what we're seeing is that North Carolina is ground zero for environmental justice. And the people who are impacted the most by storms like Florence, Hurricane Florence, and by climate change tend to be people who are low income, you know, people of low wealth, poor people, and also people of color. And it's really important that we set the stage so that we have less chance of superstorms like Florence, that we really take a stand on combating climate change, and that we do it now, because we're in such a crisis right now, not only in North Carolina, okay, but of course, across the world. We saw what happened in Puerto Rico, and with solar power, with battery backup storage, and then wind also, we can really make a difference and make a dent in this problem.
We sure could. Kim, thank you very much for that lovely statement. I want to come back to talk to you in a bit about the coal ash and, you know, how that might fit in, all the coal ash that was blown away in the storm, what that's really going to cost us. Mustafa Ali, where are you at right now? Where are you talking to us from?
Well, just jumped off a plane from Pittsburgh. Right now I'm in Washington, D.C.
All right. And what do you got to add to this dialogue about the coming of a complete solartopia and phasing out King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas?
Oh, without a doubt. Well, you know, I'll be real brief because I like to deal with facts. You know, I've been working on environmental justice and climate issues for the past couple of decades now, and sometimes folks fail to realize that in our country, because of the use of fossil fuels, we have 200,000 people who die prematurely from air pollution. We have 27 million people who have asthma, 7 million children, and disproportionately it is African-American and Latino children who are the ones who are going to the emergency rooms and the ones who are losing their lives, and it's directly connected to the use of fossil fuels. We know that we spend about $80 billion a year also on asthma-related impacts. So as we make this transition to renewables and create these new economic opportunities as well, we can really transform our most vulnerable communities, communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous populations, and really begin to make the change that's necessary. When we don't do that, that's when we see these impacts that are happening, not just from severe climate events, but also from these public health, what I also consider to be extreme tragedies, by us continuing to stay so wedded to the fossil fuel industry. And that's why it's so extremely important, with the information that the guests have been showing and sharing here today on the show, for us to make that transition. That transition has to happen, one, because of the public health impacts, two, because of the economic opportunities that it provides for, you know, a number of different people in our community who often have been forgotten, who have been unseen, and who haven't been able to participate in a full way in our economic systems.
Well, I want to put in here, and we're going to come back to Joel Siegel here. Two things I want to ask you about, Joel, real quick. You are in North Carolina. What is happening with this toxic coal ash? To my understanding, I haven't read about major toxic coal ash spills. This is something that they don't put into the calculus when they talk about the cost of coal. You know, coal has been billed as this really cheap energy source, but we don't deal with the ancillary costs, just like we didn't deal with the ancillary damage when we attacked Iraq. But what is this coal ash spill looking about? What are we looking like? What do we know about it at this point in time?
Well, I have to tell you, Kim Porter, in my opinion, is one of the nation's experts on coal ash. So I can't, you know, fill her shoes, but I'll try. I do want to say that my brother, Mustafa Ali, was the former senior advisor to President Obama on environmental justice and was the ranking official at EPA. He was number two at EPA and probably would have been the director of the EPA if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency. And he smartly left when Trump came into office because he was in their crosshairs because he's too powerful. He worked for Congressman Conyers, actually my mentor, and got me into climate change, environmental justice, just invited me to a conference. But I feel like I'm on the L.A. Lakers all-star team with Magic and Kareem with all these people on the phone here. In terms of coal ash, one thing we do know is if we didn't burn coal, there would be no coal ash. So we have to rapidly transition completely off of coal and frack gas and go to Solartopia. That's number one. Number two, during the Hurricane Florence, there was so much flooding that there's been another coal ash release into the lakes, and that is now running off into the ocean. They just had a NASA image in the Charlotte Observer where they've shown all the pollution that's now going into the Atlantic Ocean, which is going to kill fish. It's going to kill, you know, wildlife and et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is that Duke Energy, you know, promises to clean up these coal ash pits, and they don't. And they get into the groundwater and the underground aquifers, and you know, they're toxic. And when I turn on my spigot, I really am afraid. I'm afraid to drink out of my spigot, as are thousands of other people who are aware of coal ash, because I don't know if there's going to be mercury coming out of my faucet. And with my grandkids who are in Wilmington, I really worry about, you know, what they're drinking, because along with the coal ashes, you know, hog waste, and now we have, you know, nuclear power plants, right, that took direct hits that you showed me when I was with you in L.A. But it is an absolute, you know, crisis and because of this hurricane. And given that, you know, 12,000 climate scientists have said unanimously that we got to about 2020, to rapidly transition off of fossil fuels, or else we're going to be fossil fools, right? You know, it is really scary because we're going to have more hurricanes. But the biggest problem is what Michael Mann calls the stalling effect. And that's when the hurricanes go over the mid-Atlantic states and recently Houston. And they go very slowly, but they hover over the state. And due to evaporation, right, because of the higher temperatures of water in our lake streams and ocean, they're now dumping 20 to 40 inches of rain. So that's not a, it's not El Nino, right? This is going to be the new normal. That means the coal ash pits, are, it's going to happen again and again and again.
Well, and this coal ash, these coal ash spills in North Carolina, along with the hog waste and I guess chicken waste as well, this is an environmental catastrophe of the first order. I mean, it's not quite Chernobyl or Fukushima, but you know, I can't imagine the long term ecological impact of this. You know, Nancy Laplaca, you're in North Carolina. What can you tell us about this? Nancy, are you there?
Yes.
She might be gone. Oh, you are. Yes.
Yeah,
Do you
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No. Do you have any specific to tell us about the coal ash spills?
And that is that coal ash, the cost of coal ash is not included. In fact, I remember around 2010, I went to a regulators conference where they estimated that the cost to clean up every coal ash basin in the country would be about $20 billion. So that's about 600 coal ash pits for $20 billion. Well, here in North Carolina, we have 32 at 16 different locations. And the cost is $10 to $15 billion alone. So that shows you how much they are underestimating the cost to clean up coal ash. And, in fact, that is probably why they declared coal ash non-hazardous waste.
They declare coal ash non-hazardous? God.
Yes. So that's when Obama was still around. And there was a big fight. It was like subpart C or subpart D. I'm sure Mustafa knows. And the bottom line was they declared it non-hazardous, even though it is hazardous. Maybe you could talk about that, Mustafa. And so basically what they did was they let themselves off the hook, not only so that they can you know, don't have to dispose of hazardous waste, but also so that the coal ash can now be trucked and dumped to city landfills. That's municipal landfills. And if you Google municipal landfills and coal ash, you will see that there's a series of scandals going on across the country where coal ash is getting dumped into municipal landfills.
God, well, you know, Kim, before I flip out here. Kim Porter, do you want to jump in on this?
Well, just, I mean, in our country, coal power plants, they're producing 130 million tons of coal ash a year, you know, 1,100 sites, 37 states. A recent Duke University study showed that there were 21 unlined disposal coal ash sites where there were leaks in five southeastern states, so 21 of those. What we saw with Florence, of course, there was a spill at Sutton, which is near Wilmington, and then a spill at Lee, which is located near Goldsboro, and then the Brookhaven landfill in Chatham County had a collapse at their landfill. So, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to see a lot more. In 2014, one of the largest coal ash spills in United States history happened right in North Carolina with the Dan River spill. And, you know, there's still repercussions from that. I mean, just 39,000 tons of coal ash was spilled, 90 miles of the river was contaminated, and only about approximately 1% of the river has been cleaned up from that. And Duke Energy tried to pass the cost of the cleanup on to customers instead of, you know, take it away from their profits. So, again, it's just another sign where corporations' interests are put above the people, the needs of the people, and that's what we need to stop. And with Hurricane Florence, you know, in these coal ash pits in the Hog Lagoons, we don't even have any clue how bad the damage is. I mean, I've said a few of the things that we know about, but there's still much more that needs to be assessed.
We don't know how.
All right, let's ask you.
You know, with the arsenic, mercury, lead, other elements in the coal ash, I think we're going to find out a lot more. And then the fact that Duke Energy is wanting to bring the Atlantic Coast Pipeline to North Carolina, we don't need that methane. We don't need that fracking gas. We have the solution. We need to promote and be utilizing solar with battery, local solar with battery backup storage. And after the wind moratorium is lifted, we need to utilize more wind. And that's the solution, and that's what we need to be focused on so we can prevent such devastating storms as what we saw with, you know, Hurricane Florence. I mean, we know there's such a thing as natural disaster, but we also know that much of what we're seeing with climate and climate chaos has been exacerbated by man-made contributions, mainly by, you know, corporations and those profits. And so that's what we need to be fighting against.
You're absolutely right, 100%. Mustafa Ali, do you want to tell us more about, you know, I've been dealing with nuclear waste and radioactive disasters for the last 45 years, but coal ash is right up there. Mustafa Ali, what can you tell us about what we can expect in terms of this and future coal ash spills?
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have a lot more. You know, the new floods, you know, these new extreme weather events, the flooding, the rains are going to, you know, cause additional breaching that happens in these ponds where this, you know, this toxic soup is held. And unfortunately, people are making profit off of it, so they are not taking people's lives into consideration. You know, both Kim and Nancy, you know, they just aptly spelled it out for everyone, and I hope people are paying attention. You know, not only do we have these ponds that have it, then when folks remove that, and they, in many instances, as was shared, take it to these landfills. And I've never seen in the 25 years that I've been doing this a landfill that hasn't eventually, you know, end up having some type of a breach or a liner being broken. We've got landfills all across the country that are grandfathered in that don't even have liners in them, and yet we still put this type of waste in there, and then it leaks into our water bodies and gets into the drinking water. So, you know, we got to be really, really focused on moving away from, of course, these fossil fuels, but also making sure that this waste that has been left behind is taken care of and disposed properly. And if we don't, we're going to have a number of different conditions and diseases that are going to continue to exacerbate, especially in low-income communities and in communities of color. Now, there's no way of escaping what those impacts are going to be, because as Kim shared with everyone, mercury is a byproduct of coal ash. Arsenic is a byproduct of coal ash. Cadmium is a byproduct of coal ash. All of these things are nasty. It makes no sense for coal ash not to be regulated and not to be listed as one of those toxic products.
Man, you know, you have to really wonder about the future of our species. I will mention that in the middle of Florence, there was also a major crisis at the Brunswick nuclear plant. We haven't heard anything about it, but you have to assume the worst when it comes to nuclear power. And I'm sure there's plenty of issues that arose. I do know they were in hot shutdown. I mean, the good news is that these technologies that can replace coal, oil, nukes, and gas have come on so strong. Joel Siegel, the political climate in North Carolina in the wake of this accident, of this hurricane and the accidents that came with it, do you see any hope of moving forward with decent legislation that has teeth in it in North Carolina?
Yes. You know, you're listening to two of the experts on clean energy on this phone, Kim Porter and Nancy LaPlaca. But there's a...
And Mustafa seems to be pretty on top of it, too. So what do you think is going to happen now in North Carolina?
He's national and international and North Carolina. He's everywhere. If you look at MSNBC, you'll see Mustafa regularly. He just actually was on, I saw him on C-SPAN actually with Al Gore, who Poor People's Campaign is establishing.
So is there going to be a positive move to, I mean, is anybody going to learn anything from this, this massive ecological catastrophe that Florence has brought on?
It's already happening, because I've noticed in my conversations with our state legislators, both in the House and the Senate, they are much more receptive and much more in tune with the kinds of bills that we want to introduce, like, you know, banning fracking, banning all new fossil fuel infrastructure, replicating what got passed in the California General Assembly. By 2045, all electricity would be generated by, you know, clean energy. Nancy LaPlaca has talked about an idea where there would be mandatory hearings on the ACP pipeline. That's a 600-mile underground pipeline, which can destroy, you know, our planet, going through North and South Carolina, ending up in Alba, Georgia, fracking the gas from West Virginia. Yes, the answer is yes, but it depends on our movement. If in North Carolina, and this is where I think the Poor People's Campaign is pivotal, and I had this conversation with William Barber III yesterday, and I've been talking to Kim about this for a long time. I see the Poor People's Campaign is going to be the single most important force, not only in North Carolina, but nationally, along with groups like the Hip Hop Caucus and other organizations, to create a united front, a solidarity coalition for 100% clean energy. But what the hurricane has done, it's made it real to everybody, the press, the elected officials, you know, my daughter, whose house was really damaged in Wilmington. People are now starting to wonder, you know what, first it was Puerto Rico, then it was Houston, then it was Katrina, then it was Sandy, then it was Irma, Maria, and now Florence, and they're connecting the dots, but it's going to be up to we, the citizens, to do town hall meetings, teach-ins, symposiums at universities to explain to the public the relationship between climate change, right, and fossil fuels. So one of the things I talked about when I was in Los Angeles, thanks to you, Harvey, was I spoke to senior officials at Pacifica Radio about doing a national town hall meeting with our experts on climate change and members of Congress and dignitaries, so we can do a massive, intensive education campaign, because we need climate literacy, because we don't have much time. We've got about a year and a half.
Okay. And unfortunately, yeah, we don't have much time left on this show. Joel, sure. Siegel, I'm going to swing through. Everybody will get a minute or two. Joel Siegel, how do people get a hold of you?
You can just email me at joel.r.siegel@gmail.com.
All right. Very good. Nancy LaPlaca, a couple of minutes, please.
Yeah.
Do you want to wrap up?
I want to wrap up by saying that, you know, the problem with where we are right now is that even though clean energy is really cheap, the barriers are political and regulatory. And it's almost like there's two layers of politics, because the regulators are generally appointed by the governor. And so, or there's a handful of states, there's eight where they're elected. So the problem is also that we have a process that's opaque, that's difficult, that's complicated, and it doesn't need to be. There are a few simple rules we could change. In Germany, they have three rules, and these three rules are the reason why clean energy has rocketed to the top. And that's number one, anybody can access the grid. Number two, anybody can sell electricity. And number three, when you generate clean electricity, it goes to the top of the dispatch list. We don't have those in our country. And
so, all right, we'll keep them on the model. Nancy, how do people get a hold of you?
Just Google my name, Nancy LaPlaca, and it will come right up.
All right, very good. And thank you so much. I have to have you back. The problem with having such great people on is that the time really flies. Kim Porter, 2 minutes, please, and how to wrap up here.
Sure. I mean, one of the things is people need to get out and vote. People need to register. People who are registered need to vote. We need to also have people who are worth voting for. The organizations I work for are nonpartisan, but we need to be looking at the issues. We all need to work together. We need to get out of our silos, and different organizations need to come together and fight for what's right. We need to hold our politicians accountable. There's a little town called Walnut Cove in North Carolina, and a couple years ago, we were fighting for a moratorium against fracking. And you know what? this city council, this city town council, at first was not for the moratorium against fracking. What happened was the residents there, they rose up, they fought back, they went to the hearings, and they were able to put out several of the politicians who were against that moratorium for fracking. So we really saw a big change, and that can happen all over the place.
All right. And how do people get a hold of you, Kim? How do people get a hold of you and find out more? How do people get a hold of you and find out more? We're running out of time. Mustafa, we'll have to come back to you next time.
Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve?
Thank you both. Thank you all very much.
Relief funds.
It's a beautiful show, and we'll have we'll get back to you again. Okay. See you again next week in Solartopia. Thanks to the crew in New York. We'll be back next week.
Solartopia, 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 don't you?